Charles' home at Awarden, a small Welsh village near the border of England. He jotted in his diary, talked all night nearly, wife a good woman. He was trying to persuade Morel to found an organization devoted solely to campaigning for justice in the Congo, but Morel was at first reluctant. The Aborigines Protection Society was wary at the prospect of a new group encroaching on its turf and perhaps cutting into its fundraising. But Morel's wife, Mary, agreed with Casement, and it may have been at her urging that Morel went to Ireland to talk further with Casement. He wrote, "Casement's plan found fervid support in my wife, and if I crossed the Irish Channel to meet him, it was very largely owing to her influence. It was on that Irish soil, fertilized by so many human tears, that Casement and I conspired further, and discussed ways and means and drew up a rough plan of campaign." The men talked over dinner at the Slieve Donard Hotel in Newcastle, where Morel became convinced that the Congo evil was a special and extraordinary evil calling for special means of attack. If the British people could be really roused, the world might be roused. Britain had played that part before in the campaign against slavery. Could we raise a throbbing in that great heart of hers? Although he was between posts, Casement was still a member of the consular service, so Morel would have to run the new organization. But how were the vulgar details to be overcome? I explained to Casement that I had no money. Neither had he. Without a moment's hesitation, he wrote out a check for £100. For Casement, this was more than a month's income. Shortly afterward, Casement wrote to Morel, "We shall grow in numbers day by day until there go up from the length and breadth of England one overwhelming nay." A few weeks after their dinner in Ireland, Morel formed the Congo Reform Association. Using some of Casement's donation, he bought the first supplies, including a typewriter. He rounded up the public endorsement of an impressive list of lords, earls, businessmen, churchmen, members of parliament, and, to evoke the heritage of the battle against slavery, the great-grandson of the famous British abolitionist William Wilberforce. The CRA attracted more than 1,000 people to its first meeting in Liverpool's Philharmonic Hall on March 23, 1904. Although Casement and Morel each had his prickly side, the friendship between them was immediate and lasting. "I think Casement is about as near to being a saint as a man can be," Morel wrote to a friend. Each now had the perfect ally. The relationship deepened over the years. In their many letters back and forth, Casement became "Dear Tiger" and Morel "Dear Bulldog." Leopold was "the King of Beasts." Although he could be only a silent partner in the reform campaign, Casement urged on Bulldog with enthusiastic advice about political strategy, about whom to lobby, even about what clothes to wear. Without the Foreign Office's knowledge, he helped to raise money for the campaign. Morel, for his part, encouraged Casement to return to the Congo to conduct a further investigation. The consul replied that officials might "hang me as they did Stokes, and one couldn't do better than be hanged in order to end that den of devils." This is not the last time that we will hear from Casement a hint of a desire for martyrdom. That meeting between Bulldog and Tiger as they plotted their attack on the King of Beasts would later be compared by their admirers with the legendary conversation beneath a spreading tree between William Wilberforce and William Pitt the Younger more than 100 years earlier, which marked the beginning of the British anti-slavery movement. But like the British abolitionists, Morel and Casement were for the moment safe in England. For all their goodwill, they were not themselves subject to the lash of the chicot or the weight of shackles. They were white men trying to stop other white men from brutalizing Africans. Most of the Africans who fought this battle in the Congo perished, their very names unrecorded. In a sense, we honor Morel and Casement in their stead. The two men, however, were far more than armchair do-gooders. They were people of conviction, and both ended up paying a high price. At the time they met and shared their passion about the Congo in December 1903, Morel and Casement did not know that more than 12 years later they would have something else in common. Each would be taken, in custody, through the gates of London's Pentonville Prison. One would never emerge. Chapter 14. To Flood His Deeds with Day. The crusade that E.D. Morel now orchestrated through the Congo Reform Association exerted a relentless, growing pressure on the Belgian, British, and American governments. Almost never has one man, possessed of no wealth, title, or official post, caused so much trouble for the governments of several major countries. Morrell knew that officials, like Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey, would act only when kicked, and if the process of kicking is stopped, he will do nothing. To this kicking, Morrell devoted more than a decade of his life. In addition to running the Congo Reform Association, Morrell continued to spend part of each workday, which sometimes stretched to 16 or 18 hours, editing his West African Mail. People don't seem altogether to realize that, apart from everything else, I turn out a weekly paper, he wrote to a fellow activist, plus a monthly organ for the CRA, whose size sometimes has been very great and would have kept an ordinary individual pretty well busy all the month. It is only because I am an exceptionally rapid worker that I have been able to do it all. Another reason Morrell could do it all was that he had a devoted wife to run his household. Indeed, he is one of the few people in this entire story who was happily married. Mary Richardson Morrell raised their 5 children and encouraged her husband's cause in every way. She took a particular liking to Casement, agreeing with him that her husband ought to form an organization that focused exclusively on the Congo. As with so many couples of their day, we do not know how many of Morrell's memorable achievements should also be credited to her. I always think of her as part of you, John Holt, his long-time staunch supporter and confidant, wrote him, the two constituting the Morrell of Congo Reform. Morrell was not without flaws. He could be bull-headed, he rarely admitted any mistakes, and in his newspaper he ran an occasional picture of himself, enthusiastic reviews of his books, resolutions thanking him for his good work, interviews with himself reprinted from other papers, and an editorial wishing Mr. Morrell Godspeed on his journey when he went abroad to campaign for Congo reform. He sometimes clashed with colleagues who were, he felt, getting too much of the limelight, although seldom with Casement, whom he venerated. Like many enormously productive people, he had spells of depression and self-pity. My home life is reduced to microscopic proportions. Personally, I am at the end of my tether, he wrote in 1906 to Mark Twain, declaring that he would go on with his Congo work nonetheless because those wretched people out there have no one but us after all, and they have the right to live. His politics also had limitations. Some of these he shared with most other Europeans of his time, from his faith in the magic of free trade to his belief that African men had a higher sexual drive than white men and could pose a danger to white women. Other quirks were more rooted in his single-minded passion for stopping the atrocities in King Leopold's Congo. The picture Morrell gives in his writings of Africans in the Congo before whites arrived is that of Rousseau's idealized noble savage. In describing traditional African societies, he focuses on what was peaceful and gentle and ignores any brutal aspects, which occasionally included, for example, long before the force publique made it the order of the day, cutting off the hands of one's dead enemies. More important, Morrell was so enraged by Leopold's villainy that he ignored his own country's use of forced labor, wide though far less murderous, in its African colonies, particularly in the East and South. There was nothing inherently wrong with colonialism, he felt, if its administration was fair and just. He believed this to be the case in the British colonies in West Africa, where, to be sure, there was no rubber terror and no massive seizure of all so-called vacant land. In the later stages of his Congo campaign, he even found time to go to Nigeria and write a generally approving book about British rule there. But whatever his faults, when it came to campaigning against injustice in the Congo, Morrell had an unswerving, infectious sense of right and wrong. A superb speaker, he regularly addressed crowds of several thousand people with no notes. Between 1907 and 1909 alone, he spoke at some 50 mass meetings throughout Great Britain. Sometimes, he wrote, I have had bursts of fury when some story more abominable than the rest moved me in a special way, and when I should have stopped at very little if any of Leopold's crew had been about. I have experienced exhilaration when I had driven home some good thrust, or when that something or other which it is difficult to name gripped me on the platform, and I felt I had a great audience in the hollow of my hand. Morrell considered his movement to be in the grand tradition of such British humanitarian crusades as the righteous outrage provoked by the Turkish massacres of Bulgarians in 1876 and of Armenians in the 1890s. Above all, he saw himself as a moral heir to the anti-slavery movement. He began his blistering Red Rubber, the story of the rubber slave trade flourishing on the Congo in the year of grace 1906, with an epigraph from the great American abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. The standard of emancipation is now unfurled. I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. Posterity will bear testimony that I was right. The tradition of British radicalism from which Morel came was rooted in the nonconformist, that is, Protestant but not Church of England, churches, and in the Clapham sect, the humanitarian evangelical group to which the anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce had belonged. In the early 19th century, these humanitarians had focused their zeal on improving the condition of all sorts of oppressed groups – prisoners, factory workers, child labourers, the insane. Theirs, however, was not the from-the-bottom-up politics later adopted by Marxists and trade unionists. It was the top-down reformism of the relatively well-born. They aimed at ending the death penalty, corporal punishment, and cruelty to animals. When they turned their attention overseas, it was to push for the abolition of the slave trade and to send missionaries abroad to uplift the natives in the far reaches of the world. Indeed, it was the non-conformist churches, especially the Baptists, that sent the British missionaries to the Congo. Significantly, Morel's humanitarian political ancestors, unlike his socialist contemporaries, had firmly believed that improving the lot of downtrodden people everywhere was good for business. Better treatment of colonial subjects would promote the civil and commercial interests of Great Britain, declared a parliamentary select committee in the 1830s. Savages are dangerous neighbours and unprofitable customers, and if they remain as degraded denizens of our colonies, they become a burden upon the state. Such humanitarians never saw themselves as being in conflict with the imperial project, as long as it was British imperialism. Morally, emancipation put the British on a special plane, as James Morris sums it up in his History of the British Empire. If so much could be achieved by agitation at home, what might not be done if the moral authority of England were distributed across the earth, to tackle the evils of slavery, ignorance, and paganism at source, to teach the simpler peoples the benefits of steam, free trade, and revealed religion, and to establish not a world empire in the bad Napoleonic sense, but a moral empire of loftier intent. So was evolved the chemistry of evangelical imperialism. This was the tradition in which Morel felt at home, and it was a tradition that perfectly suited his organizational talent. Although without old-school ties to them, he had the knack of making the wealthy, the powerful, and the famous believe they did credit to themselves by supporting his Congo crusade. Month after month, the front page of the Congo Reform Association's periodical carried a full-page portrait photo of a prominent supporter. A lord, an earl, a member of parliament, a mustachioed retired colonial governor. After the association's founding in Liverpool, Morel saw to it that the first meeting of the group's executive committee was held in a room secured by a sympathetic MP at the House of Commons. Almost every major CRA public meeting after that had at least one bishop on the platform. Having the apparent blessing of both church and state, Morel found that few influential Britons could resist his entreaties to lend their names to the cause of Congo reform. One of his political limitations was, in fact, a source of his immense success as an organizer. If he had believed, as we might conclude today, that Leopold's rape of the Congo was in part a logical consequence of the very idea of colonialism, of the belief that there was nothing wrong with a country being ruled other than by its own inhabitants, Morel would have been written off as being on the fringe. No one in England would have paid much attention to him. But he did not believe this. He believed with all his heart that Leopold's system of rule constituted a unique form of evil. People in England's ruling circles, therefore, could support his crusade without feeling their own interests threatened. Yet despite some blind spots, Morel was at the far edge of the humanitarian tradition. His beliefs were implicitly more subversive than he allowed himself to recognize. He saw brutality in the Congo not as a specific imperfection to be wiped out in the way one could wipe out child labour or capital punishment by passing a law against it, but as part of a complex, deeply embedded system, as he called it, forced labour plus the massive European takeover of African land. This angle of vision is much closer to Marxism than to uplift the downtrodden humanitarianism, although Morel probably never read a word of Marx in his life. He never resolved the conflict between these two ways of seeing the world, and much of the drama of his later life lay in the constant tension between them. Morel has never had an equal as organizer and leader of a dissenting movement, writes the historian A.J.P. Taylor. He knew exactly where to look for rich sympathizers, and he took money from them without altering the democratic character of his movement. Millionaires and factory workers alike accepted his leadership. Among the millionaires were Quakers like the wealthy but plain-living chocolate manufacturer William Cadbury. Subsidies from these supporters kept the West African mail alive, and it was the newspaper, not the Congo Reform Association, that paid Morel's salary. Paradoxically, Sir Alfred Jones of the Elder Dempster line also invested a little money in the paper, doubtless hoping to soften the attitude of his former employee. But his hopes were in vain. Morel repeatedly attacked Jones without mercy, exposing his doings as Leopold's major British ally. When Jones saw he would have no influence, he pulled his advertising from the paper. Morel knew exactly how to fit his message to his audience. He reminded British businessmen that Leopold's monopolistic system, copied by France, had shut them out of much Congo trade. To members of the clergy, he talked of Christian responsibility and quoted the grim reports from the missionaries. And for all Britons and their representatives in Parliament, he evoked the widespread, though unspoken, belief that England had a particular responsibility to make decency prevail in the universe. One of the more surprising things about the Congo Crusade was that, except for forays to speak at meetings, Morel conducted it largely from his study. During the first half of the Congo Reform Association's 9-year lifetime, he didn't even live in London. Until December 1908, the CRA's head office was in Liverpool. From there, and from his home in nearby Hawarden, Morel kept up a voluminous correspondence. In the first 6 months of 1906, for instance, he wrote 3,700 letters. More important, his prodigious output of books, pamphlets, and newspaper articles about the Congo inspired people to write to him. He carefully cross-checked news items for accuracy, studied newspapers and documents from Belgium, and corresponded with government officials, journalists, and traders in Europe and Africa. By 1908, he estimated that he had amassed about 20,000 letters concerning the Congo. They served as the basis for much of his published work. Despite his disdain for organized religion, his tone was that of an evangelical preacher. To him, Leopold and his supporters, such as the reptile Congophile press of Brussels and Antwerp, personified the devil. The Congo administration was a bad and wicked system, inflicting terrible wrongs upon the native races. Morel spoke effectively to the mood of the day because he shared it. The optimism, the boundless confidence of a society that had not yet seen or imagined the world wars. The belief that humankind had the capacity to briskly eradicate all barriers that lay in the path of progress. "Our forefathers smashed the overseas slave trade," he declared in his book, King Leopold's Rule in Africa, "and we shall root out the modern inland slave trade on the Congo." He was eager to raise the Congo reform movement above partisan politics and religious differences. On the speaker's platform for his major events were always MPs from the three major parties, clergy from both the Church of England and the Nonconformist Churches, and an assortment of Right Honourables, Lord Mayors, Lord Provosts, and other notables. He had a superb sense of how to build up to an event. A large regional Congo protest rally was often preceded by an afternoon meeting with the local mayor and dignitaries at City Hall. The mayor would then be on stage that evening. Before the end of 1905, more than 60 mass meetings had adopted a resolution condemning Leopold's rule as a revival of the African slave trade, and calling upon His Majesty's government to convoke an assembly of the Christian powers in order to devise and put in force a scheme for the good government of the Congo territories. In Liverpool, an audience overflowed an auditorium that seated nearly 3,000 and filled two adjoining halls. Cries of "shame, shame" resounded at similar meetings throughout England and Scotland. A master of all the media of his day, Morel made particularly effective use of photography. A central part of almost every Congo protest meeting was a slideshow, comprising some 60 vivid photos of life under Leopold's rule. Half a dozen of them showed mutilated Africans or their cut-off hands. The pictures, ultimately seen in meetings and the press by millions of people, provided evidence that no propaganda could refute. Slides also showed charts and graphs estimating Leopold's Congo profits. They even displayed poems which made up in passion what they lacked in art. No zeal, no faith inspired this Leopold, nor any madness of half-splendid birth. Cool-eyed, he loosed the hounds that rend and slay, just that his coffers might be gorged with gold. Embalm him, time, forget him not, O earth, trumpet his name and flood his deeds with day. To flood Leopold's deeds with day required that Morel mobilize his fellow journalists. He knew the editors of most of the major British magazines and newspapers and wrote regularly for many of them, including the most prestigious, The Times. When an editor needed to send a reporter to Belgium or the Congo, Morel always had a candidate to suggest. He engineered the downfall, he happily claimed, of a Times Brussels correspondent whom he thought too friendly to Leopold. He fed information to sympathetic newspapers in Belgium, and through his connections to the Press Association wire service, was able to distribute material worldwide. When the famous American correspondent Richard Harding Davis was sent to Africa by Collier's magazine, he went supplied with Morel's latest findings and echoed them in what he wrote. With a powerful boost from Casement's report, the international campaign mounted by Morel reached newspapers all over the world. His carefully kept files contain, for the 10 years starting in 1902, 4,194 clippings related to the drive for Congo reform. Nor did he focus on newspapers alone. The author of a 1906 boys' adventure novel, Samba, A Story of the Rubber Slaves of the Congo, thanks CRA officials in his preface for their kindness in reading the manuscript and revising the proofs of this book, and for many most helpful suggestions and criticisms. Morel described himself as Congo-possessed. A letter to his Quaker backer William Cadbury in 1906 shows how. Book, out this week. This was red rubber. Glasgow, Lord Provost has summoned a town's meeting. Shall probably have to go. Am arranging for formation of local CRA. Any prominent friends in Glasgow you could drop a note to? France, a French CRA will be formed this month. Rising tide. Demands for literature literally coming in shoals. 12 to 20 letters per day for literature, information, etc. Like the abolitionists before him, Morel understood that every national organization had to have local branches, so the CRA had auxiliaries throughout England and Scotland. These groups organized their members to send funds, to write to their representatives in Parliament, and to produce an unending flow of letters to local newspapers. A ladies' branch had 2 representatives on the CRA Executive Committee. Through such means, Morel applied steady pressure on the British government. He and his supporters never doubted that if only Britain were to act, it could force Leopold to mend his ways or could wrest the Congo entirely from his grasp. The most effective spokespeople of all, Morel knew, were those with first-hand knowledge. Starting in 1906, the returned Baptist missionaries, the Reverend John Harris and his wife, Alice Seeley Harris, she had taken almost all the photographs Morel used, began working full-time for the association. The Harris's zeal matched Morel's. In their first 2 years with the CRA, one or both of them spoke in public on 600 occasions. A woman in a large audience in Wales was so moved that she handed Alice Harris her jewels to be sold for the benefit of the movement. The Harrises displayed chicots and shackles, and throughout England they led church congregations in special hymns on Congo Sundays. To shocked audiences they described personal experiences like this one, which John Harris later put down on paper. Lined up are 40 emaciated sons of an African village, each carrying his little basket of rubber. The toll of rubber is weighed and accepted, but 4 baskets are short of the demand. The order is brutally short and sharp. Quickly, the first defaulter is seized by 4 lusty executioners, thrown on the bare ground, pinioned hands and feet, whilst a 5th steps forward carrying a long whip of twisted hippo hide. Swiftly and without cessation, the whip falls, and the sharp, corrugated edges cut deep into the flesh. On back, shoulders and buttocks, blood spurts from a 12 places. In vain the victim twists in the grip of the executioners, and then the whip cuts other parts of the quivering body. And in the case of one of the 4, upon the most sensitive part of the human frame. The 100 lashes each left 4 inert bodies bloody and quivering on the shimmering sand of the rubber collecting post. Following hard upon this decisive incident was another. Breakfast was just finished when an African father rushed up the veranda steps of our mud house and laid upon the ground the hand and foot of his little daughter, whose age could not have been more than 5 years. As Morel's campaign surged forward in Europe, frantic messages flowed from Brussels to the Congo capital of Boma, and from there to the most remote outposts. Near the British mission station where the Harrises had been working, the state posted a deputy public prosecutor. The Governor-General wrote to him, "The main reason for your being placed at Baringa is to keep the government regularly informed of everything of interest in the Baringa region concerning the missionaries' agitation. It will probably be necessary for you to have several blacks working for you who could gather useful information in the villages of the region, especially when the missionaries go travelling. I authorize you to hire 5 workers towards this end. I have given instructions to the Commissioner General of the Equator District to furnish you the necessary funds. You will use the funds as seems best to you, whether in hiring black workers or in giving presents to certain natives living in the villages who can keep you up to date. It goes without saying that this must be done with the greatest discretion." In the following months, the public prosecutor at Boma wrote to his deputy at Baringa, asking him to find out what plans were to be hatched at a forthcoming meeting of Protestant missionaries. Some weeks later, this was followed by a collection of 7 months' worth of Morel's West African mail, and the news that further issues would be forwarded as soon as they arrived at the capital. "I particularly draw your attention to the importance for the government in noting all the inaccuracies in the missionaries' accusations, in order to show the bad faith that inspires their attacks against the state. It is important that each of these issues be the object of your most careful examination and of a report that you send me of inaccuracies." As the attacks on Leopold mounted, the regime steadily increased its scrutiny of Morel's allies in the Congo. None was at more risk than Hezekiah Andrew Shanu. Britain had established its colonies in Africa long before Leopold, and in its early days the Congo state turned to these territories to recruit experienced labourers, soldiers, and other personnel. Shanu was born and educated in what is today Nigeria, and became a schoolteacher. In 1884, he began working for Leopold's regime. One task was to recruit soldiers from his homeland for the force publique. When he became a clerk and French-English translator on the Governor-General's staff at Boma, he brought his wife, brother-in-law, and other members of his family from Lagos to live in the Congo. In 1893, he left state service to go into business for himself. The following year, he went to Belgium, where he ordered himself a piano and a steam launch and put his son in school. In all countries with colonies, there is a ready audience for grateful subjects, and Shanu was received with much enthusiasm when he lectured on the Congo and thanked the Belgians for their good works. One newspaper noted approvingly that Shanu expresses himself in French with the greatest correctness. Another patronizingly remembered him as a striking example of the perfectibility of the Negro race. An august-looking man, Shanu wore a starched white collar on public occasions with the ribbon of a Congo state medal on his jacket lapel. After visits to England, France, and Germany, Shanu returned to the Congo and, in a remarkable move in this state set up by Europeans for their own benefit, became a successful businessman. In Boma, he opened a well-stocked store selling canned food and other supplies from Europe. In addition, he operated a tailor's shop and laundry and ran small lodging houses both in Boma and the railhead town of Matadi. He enjoyed photography and had some of his pictures published in the Brussels magazine Le Congo Illustré. When he leased a house he owned to an early British vice-consul, he made so great an impression that the man recommended Shanu to the Foreign Office as his replacement during a home leave. Shanu was also respected by his former employers. During a force publique mutiny at Boma in 1900, state officials gratefully accepted his help in preventing the rebellion from spreading to West Africans working in the town. He even offered to take up arms against the mutineers. Monsieur Shanu, in these troubled moments, has given proof of his sincere loyalty to the state, wrote a high Congo official. Up to this point, Shanu had thrown in his lot completely with the Congo's rulers. But something, we do not know what, caused a change of heart, and he moved into the camp of Leopold's enemies. For a black man living in the Congo capital, this was a dangerous step. One sign of his changed attitude came when he apparently supplied Roger Casement with information about the mistreatment of West African workers in the Congo. In turn, it appears that Casement told Chanu about the campaign Morel was mounting in Europe. While Casement was in the interior in 1903 making his investigation, Chanu sent a check to Morel, asking for copies of his writings. Delighted to have an African ally write in the enemy's capital, Morel immediately wrote back, sending Chanu a subscription to his newspaper, a book, and some pamphlets. "I do not know what your views on the Congo question are," he wrote, "but if they agree with mine, I shall be very glad if you can let me have information from time to time." Some weeks later, Morel wrote again, suggesting that Chanu could avoid catching the eye of the Boma postal censor by addressing his mail to Morel's father-in-law in Devon. Before long, Chanu found some useful information to send. After the protests against Leopold's rule began in Europe, the Congo state had periodically made a big show of prosecuting low-ranking white officials for atrocities against Africans. Occasionally, the convicted men were sentenced to prison terms, although most were released after serving only a fraction of their time. But trials can be risky for repressive governments. They can put damaging material on the public record. Like other small-fry scapegoats in tyrannies the world over, the defendants accused of brutal massacres in the Congo usually said they were only following orders, and often could produce witnesses or documents to prove the claim. The state therefore took care to keep the transcripts of these trials secret, and for some years virtually nothing leaked out. Morel, knowing the evidence from these trials would be a source of ammunition for the Congo reform campaign, asked Chanu to find out what he could. One especially revealing case came to a climax in early 1904. The main defendant, a trigger-happy rubber company agent named Charles Caudron, was accused of several crimes, including the murder of at least 122 Africans. In part, he was put on trial so that the state could claim it was upholding human rights, but the authorities had other motives as well. Caudron had offended the force publique commander in his area, who thought he was the one to run any military operations there. And he had spread his reign of terror so wildly that he had disrupted rubber production in a highly profitable district. The trial revealed much about government orders condoning the holding of hostages. Furthermore, the appeals court lowered Caudron's sentence because of extenuating circumstances. Invoking the familiar lazy native theme, the court referred to the great difficulties under which Caudron found himself, accomplishing his mission in the midst of a population absolutely resistant to any idea of work, and which respects no other law than force, and knows no other means of persuasion than terror. Chanu got hold of some of the court documents and secretly sent them to Morel, who published them immediately, claiming that this was the most damaging blow ever received by the Congo state. That was an overstatement, but the material was indeed damaging. And what was most embarrassing in it came from the mouths of Congo state officials themselves. It caught the eye of the British Foreign Office and was reprinted in an official report. Chanu's next contribution to the anti-Congo campaign, however, ended tragically. He acted as liaison between Morel and a Congo state official, the police chief of Boma, who claimed to have information to give or sell to the reformers. But the man turned treacherous. He attacked Morel in the Belgian press and exposed Chanu as Morel's accomplice. Morel, who considered Chanu a man of unblemished reputation and of great courage, feared for Chanu's life, and urged the British consul in Boma to do all he could to protect him. He sent offers of help to Chanu and anxiously asked for news. When it came, it was not good. Because Chanu was a British subject, the Congo authorities did not want to risk an international incident by arresting him. Instead, they harassed him unremittingly, even rescinding the medal he had been awarded for his work for the state. They then ordered all state employees not to patronize his businesses. That guaranteed that these would fail. In July 1905, Hezekiah Andrew Chanu committed suicide. At the turn of the century, the Élysée Palace Hotel, near the Arc de Triomphe, was among the most elegant in Paris. One day a guest happened to notice a young woman, also staying at the hotel, whose name, like other details of her past, remains in question. It was Caroline, or perhaps Blanche, Delacroix, or perhaps Lacroix. Although still a teenager, Caroline was the mistress of Antoine-Emmanuel Durieux, a former officer in the French army. He attempted to support them both by betting on horse races. When his betting luck ran low, it appears Durieux also acted as Caroline's pimp. Their lodgings at the Elysee Palace were a useful base for these operations, but they frequently left bills unpaid. An unexpected solution to these troubles appeared when a woman approached Caroline at the hotel and said, "Madame, I am sent to you by a gentleman who has noticed you. He is a very high personage, but his exalted position obliges me to withhold his name." A meeting was arranged for the following day. According to Caroline's not entirely reliable memoirs, Dorieux, in a top hat and pearl-grey gloves, binoculars hanging around his neck, left for the racetrack unawares. More likely, he was fully aware and had been paid off in advance. Caroline went to a secluded room in a building on the nearby Rue Lord Byron. The high personage arrived, accompanied by two aides, who took seats on either side of Caroline and began asking her questions. It was not really a conversation, it was rather a series of trite questions asked in rotation, first by one, then by the other. These questions obliged me to turn my head first to the right, then to the left. I answered them without having to think, their only aim, as I learned later, being to show off my two profiles to the mute personage. After looking over his new prize, the high personage smiled behind his beard and pronounced himself pleased. He invited Caroline to travel to Austria with him, and the next day a large sum of money arrived, as well as some empty trunks for Caroline to fill with new dresses of her choice. Her admirer had found the way to her heart, for she liked nothing better in the world than to buy clothes. Caroline was 16. King Leopold II was 65. Then, as now, nothing royal stayed secret long. Courtiers gossiped, servants whispered, and news of the scandalous romance soon filled the press of Europe. Leopold had long had a well-known taste for extremely young women, but losing his head completely over a 16-year-old call girl was a different matter entirely. His new mistress was young enough to be his granddaughter. Leopold's chaotic family life and sexual tastes are far more than incidental to the Congo story. Ironically, they probably lost him more popularity in Belgium than any of the cruelties he perpetrated in Africa. Nor did they win him friends elsewhere. After he made a state visit to Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II's puritanical wife Augusta sent her personal chaplain to exorcise the palace rooms Leopold had been staying in. This, in turn, meant that few of his people were willing to rally behind him when he became the target of an international protest movement. The king's personal foibles also turned him into an irresistible target for a world press stirred up by Morel. The large beard, now turned white, made him a cartoonist's dream. His bulky, cloaked figure stalked through the pages of Europe's newspaper, his beard dripping blood, his hands clutching shrunken heads from the Congo, his eyes hungrily devouring the dancers of a corps de ballet. He sits down to dine on a severed African head garnished with bayonets. Tsar Nicholas II complains that his knout is ineffective, so his cousin Leopold, dressed in a tiger skin, recommends the chicot. Leopold's rejected daughters sadly beg their father for Caroline's cast-off clothing. Leopold and the Sultan of Turkey share a good laugh and a bottle of wine while comparing the massacre of the Congolese to that of the Armenians. Several years into the king's liaison with his new love, his long-suffering wife, Marie Henriette, lover of horses and music, died. From this point on, the king's infatuation with Caroline became flagrantly open. He installed her in a grand mansion, the Villa Vanderbort, across the way from the royal complex at Laeken, and built a pedestrian bridge over the street so that he could slip across at will for visits. He was wildly jealous of Caroline, apparently with reason. He once caught her in the Brussels villa with Dorieux, the former officer from whom he thought he had stolen her. Dorieux, whom Caroline tried to pass off as her brother, seems to have shown up on other occasions as well. One newspaper informed its readers that Caroline and Dorieux had secret electric bells installed in all her residences so that servants could warn them if Leopold was approaching. After she moved to Brussels, Caroline continued to make frequent trips to Paris to visit her dressmaker and her hatmaker. During this period, she once bragged, she bought 3 million francs worth of dresses at a single store, Caillot's. When she complained to the king that the evening express train back to Brussels departed too early and left her too little shopping time, Leopold, rather than risk her staying in Paris and out of his sight overnight, spoke to the head of the railway. From then on, the train left an hour later. Caroline quickly learned to make use of Leopold's quirks, such as his hypochondria. One day, when I needed some free hours for myself, I obtained them by sneezing. How many times have I kept intriguing women away from the sovereign simply by telling him that they had colds? Leopold took Caroline with him everywhere. Ostensibly, she travelled incognito, but with an expanding retinue of servants, this became difficult. Shocking everyone, she accompanied the king to London in 1901 for the funeral of his cousin, Queen Victoria. The king did not entirely lose his interest in other young women. In Brussels, Paris, and elsewhere, he periodically sent his valet or another intermediary to look for candidates who met his detailed physical specifications. But Caroline was in a different category. The two of them seemed to trumpet, rather than disguise, their difference in age. She called him très vieux, and he called her très belle. To the extent that someone like Leopold was capable of love, this teenage prostitute proved to be the love of his life. But it was not only Leopold's liaison with Caroline that lost him popularity with Belgians. It began to dawn on his people that their country was gaining little financial benefit from the Congo. The bulk of the profits were going straight into Caroline's dresses and villas and, on a far larger scale, into the king's construction projects. Since Leopold had little taste for good works, literature or drama, and a well-known dislike for music, he spent his money mostly on building things, the bigger the better. For years the king had pled poverty, but as his triumphal arches, museums, and monuments sprouted around the country, he could keep up the pretense no longer. Belgians were even more upset when it became clear that their king was spending much of his newfound wealth abroad. He was soon one of the largest landowners on the French Riviera, where he built a dock for his 1,500-ton yacht, the Alberta, and had architects from Nice design and build a series of splendid villas. His property included most of the land at the end of the scenic fingertip of Cap Ferrat, then, as now, among the most expensive seaside real estate in the world. On his young mistress, Leopold showered castles and mansions. When she became pregnant, he and the French government split the cost of building a new road near her villa at Cap Ferrat, in order to give her carriage a smoother ride. When her son was born, he was given the title of Duke of Tervuren, and she became the Baroness de Vaughan. The king took her around the Mediterranean on his yacht, but the Belgian public loathed her, and her carriage was once stoned in the streets of Brussels. In the minds of Europeans, the king's public and private lives by now were wholly entwined. When Caroline's second son was born, he had a deformed hand. A cartoon in Punch showed Leopold holding the newborn child, surrounded by Congolese corpses with their hands cut off. The caption read, "Vengeance from on high." How did Leopold feel about being the target of such wrath? Clearly it exasperated him. He once wrote to an aide, "I will not let myself be soiled with blood or mud." How did Leopold feel about being the target of such wrath? Clearly it exasperated him. He once wrote to an aide, "I will not let myself be soiled with blood or mud." But the tone he sounded was always of annoyance or self-pity, never of shame or guilt. Once, when he saw a cartoon of himself in a German newspaper slicing off hands with his sword, he snorted, according to a military aide, and said, "Cut off hands. That's idiotic. I'd cut off all the rest of them, but not the hands. That's the one thing I need in the Congo." Small wonder that when the king jokingly introduced Prime Minister Auguste Birnert to a gathering as the greatest cynic in the kingdom, Birnert replied, deadpan, that he would not dare take precedence over His Majesty. Chapter 15. A Reckoning. As E.D. Morel, Roger Casement, and their allies caught Europe's attention with reports of the Holocaust in Central Africa, newspapers and magazines ran pictures of burned villages and mutilated bodies, and missionary witnesses spoke of the depopulation of entire districts. Looking at this written and photographic record today immediately raises a crucial question. What was the death toll in Leopold's Congo? This is a good moment to pause in our story to find an answer. The question is not simple. To begin with, history in this case cannot have distinct lines drawn around it, as it can, say, when we ask how many Jews the Nazis put to death between 1933 and 1945. King Leopold II's personal État indépendant du Congo officially existed for 23 years, beginning in 1885. But many Congolese were already dying unnatural deaths by the start of that period, and important elements of the king's system of exploitation endured for many years after its official end. The rubber boom, cause of the worst bloodletting in the Congo, began under Leopold's rule in the mid-1890s, but it continued several years after the end of his one-man regime. Furthermore, although the killing in the Congo was of genocidal proportions, it was not, strictly speaking, a genocide. The Congo state was not deliberately trying to eliminate one particular ethnic group from the face of the earth. Instead, like the slave dealers who raided Africa for centuries before them, Leopold's men were looking for labor. If, in the course of their finding and using that labor, millions of people died, that to them was incidental. Few officials kept statistics about something they considered so negligible as African lives. And so, estimating the number of casualties today requires considerable historical detective work. In population losses on this scale, the toll is usually a composite of figures from one or more of four closely connected sources. 1. Murder. 2. Starvation, exhaustion, and exposure. 3. Disease. And 4. A plummeting birth rate. In the worst period in the Congo, the long rubber boom, it came in abundance from all four. 1. Murder. Although outright murder was not the major cause of death in Leopold's Congo, it was most clearly documented. When a village or a district failed to supply its quota of rubber or fought back against the regime, force publique soldiers or rubber company sentries often killed everyone they could find. Those times when an eyewitness happened upon a pile of skeletons or severed hands and a report survives represent, of course, only a small proportion of the massacres carried out, only a few sparks from a firestorm. But among those scattered sparks are some that burn distinctly. In 1896, a German newspaper, the Kölnische Zeitung, published on the authority of a highly esteemed Belgian news that 1,308 severed hands had been turned over to the notorious district commissioner, Léon Fievez, in a single day. The newspaper twice repeated the story without being challenged by the Congo state. Several additional reports of that day's events, including some from both Protestant and Catholic missionaries, cited even higher totals for the number of hands. On a later occasion, Fievez admitted that the practice of cutting hands off corpses existed. He denied only, with great vehemence, that he had ever ordered hands cut off living people. In 1899, a state officer, Simon Roy, perhaps not realizing that one of the people he was chatting with was an American missionary, bragged about the killing squads under his command. The missionary, Ellsworth Farris, recorded the conversation in his diary. "Each time the corporal goes out to get rubber, cartridges are given to him. He must bring back all not used, and for every one used he must bring back a right hand. As to the extent to which this is carried on, Roy informed me that in 6 months they, the state, on the Momboyo River, had used 6,000 cartridges, which means that 6,000 people are killed or mutilated. It means more than 6,000, for the people have told me repeatedly that the soldiers kill children with the butt of their guns. The punitive expeditions against the Buja rebels altogether killed more than 1,300 Bujas. Reports of this appeared in various Belgian newspapers in 1900, one of which was subsidized by the Congo state. Dozens of other rebellions against rubber collecting broke out throughout the territory over the next decade. Estimating the death toll caused by suppressing them all is impossible, but sometimes a stray statistic carries appalling implications, when we remember that soldiers were severely punished for wasting bullets on non-human targets. Among a raft of revealing documents from the ABIR concession company that Morel got hold of is a register showing that in the year 1903, a single one of the 35 rubber-collecting posts in ABIR territory was sent a total of 159 firearms and 40,355 rounds of ammunition. The list of specific massacres on record goes on and on. The territory was awash in corpses, sometimes literally. "Where a river flows into Lake Tumba," wrote the Swedish missionary E.V. Sjöblom, "I saw dead bodies floating on the lake with the right hand cut off, and the officer told me when I came back why they had been killed. It was for the rubber. When I crossed the stream, I saw some dead bodies hanging down from the branches in the water. As I turned away my face at the horrible sight, one of the native corporals who was following us down said, 'Oh, that is nothing. A few days ago I returned from a fight, and I brought the white man 160 hands, and they were thrown into the river.'" It was not only missionaries and visitors who recorded the mass murders. Many force publique officers kept astonishingly frank diaries about the death and destruction they left behind them. At the village of Bikoro on Lake Tumba, a Swedish officer of the Force Publique, Lieutenant Knut Svensson, may have been the cause of some of the mangled bodies his countryman Sjöblom had seen. Svensson noted in his diary a death toll of 527 people in 4.5 months' time, upon the imposition of the rubber regime in 1894-1895. According to oral tradition in the area today, Svensson would assemble the people of a recalcitrant village on the pretext of signing a treaty or recruiting porters, and then simply open fire. The diary of another officer, Charles Lumaire, is chilling in its casualness. 28th of March, 1891. The village of Bokanga was burned. 4th of April, 1891. A stop at Bolebo. Since they wanted to meet us only with spears and guns, the village was burned. One native killed. 12th of April, 1891. Attack on the Ikengo villages. The big chief Ekele of Echimanjindo was killed and thrown in the water. 14th of June, 1891. Expedition against the Loliva, who refused to come to the station. Dreadful weather. Attack made in driving rain. The group of villages was large, couldn't destroy them all. Around 15 blacks killed. 14th of June, 1891. At 5 a.m. sent the Zanzibari Mechudi with about 40 men to burn Nkole. The operation was successful and everything was burned. 4th of September, 1891. At 4 a.m. preparations for attacking Ipeko. The whole village was burned and the banana trees cut down. 13th of July, 1892. The Bompopo villages were attacked 7th of July by Lieutenant Sarrazin. 20 natives killed. 13 women and children taken prisoner. From the diary of Louis Leclerc, another Force Publique officer. 21st of June, 1895. Arrived at Yambisi at 10:20 a.m. Village abandoned. We sent several groups of soldiers to scour the area. They came back several hours later with 11 heads and 9 prisoners. A canoe sent out hunting in the evening also brought back several heads. 22nd of June, 1895. They brought us 3 prisoners in the morning, 3 others towards evening, and 3 heads. A man from Bamane, running through the forest shouting for his lost wife and child, came too close to our camp and received a bullet from one of our sentries. They brought us his head. Never have I seen such an expression of despair, of fear. We burned the village. The diaries of Lemaire and Leclerc and others go on in this vein for day after day, week after week. Resistance of any kind, or even cutting corners, was fatal. E.D. Morel reprinted a message that a district commander, Jules Jacques, sent to one of his underlings after finding that some villagers had severed vines, killing them to extract the rubber, instead of merely tapping the vines as they were supposed to. Monsieur le chef de poste, decidedly these people of Inongo are a bad lot. They have just been and cut some rubber vines. We must fight them until their absolute submission has been obtained or their complete extermination. Inform the natives that if they cut another single vine, I will exterminate them to the last man. Conrad was not making much up when he had Mr. Kurtz scrawl the infamous line, "Exterminate all the brutes." 2. Starvation, exhaustion, and exposure. As news of the terror spread, hundreds of thousands of people fled their villages. In retaliation, soldiers often took their animals and burned their huts and crops, leaving them no food. This pattern of action was established even before the rubber boom, when Leopold's soldiers were looking primarily for ivory and for porters and food for themselves. A Swedish lieutenant described such a raid in 1885 in the Lower Congo Rapids district. When we were approaching, there was a terrible tumult in the village. The natives were completely taken with surprise. We could see them gather what they could of their belongings and escape into the deep, thick woods. Before I left the place, I had the village plundered of the large number of goats, hens, and ducks that were there. Then we abandoned the village and retired to a better place for our noon rest. As they fled these expeditions, villagers sometimes abandoned small children for fear that their cries would give away their hiding places. As a result, many children starved. A small proportion of the population, lucky enough to live near the Congo's borders, escaped from the country. Some 30,000 refugees, the French colonial governor estimated, had crossed into French territory by 1900. Others fled to British territory, although a number of them drowned in the Luapula River, which formed part of the border with British-owned northern Rhodesia. But for most people, there was nowhere to flee except deep into the rainforest or the swamps, where there was no shelter and little food. The American soldier of fortune, Edgar Canisius, saw refugees from his scorched earth raids living like wild beasts in the forest, subsisting on roots and ants and other insects. A fellow Presbyterian missionary of William Shepherd's wrote in 1899, "All the people of the villages run away to the forest when they hear the state officers are coming. Tonight, in the midst of the rainy season, within a radius of 75 miles of Luebo, I am sure it would be a low estimate to say that 40,000 people, men, women, children, with the sick, are sleeping in the forests without shelter." Around the same time, a young English explorer named Edward S. Grogan walked the length of Africa and was shocked at what he saw in crossing a depopulated and devastated 3,000-square-mile tract in the far northeastern part of the Congo. "Every village has been burnt to the ground, and as I fled from the country I saw skeletons, skeletons everywhere, and such postures. What tales of horror they told." Hunger also struck villagers who did not flee into the forest, because if they were near a rubber post, they had to give up much of their bananas, manioc, fish and meat to feed the soldiers. The village of Bumba in the ABIR concession, for example, had only 100 families, but it was expected each month to deliver 15 kilos of yams or similar vegetables, in addition to 5 pigs or 50 chickens. Furthermore, villages like this one usually had to come up with all the food while their able-bodied men were in the forest, desperately searching for rubber. Without the manpower to clear new garden plots, so essential in farming the fragile soil of the rainforest, the women often replanted worn-out fields. Harvests declined, and in the old ABIR region, the period is remembered today as Lonkali, the time of famine. Untold thousands of people, women, children, and the elderly, died as hostages. Soldiers kept them in dirt compounds, often in chains, feeding them little or nothing until the men of a village brought in the demanded amount of rubber, something that might take weeks. In one stockade in 1899, prisoners were found to be dying at the rate of 3 to 10 a day. 3. Disease. As with the decimation of the American Indians, disease killed many more Congolese than did bullets. Europeans and the Afro-Arab slave traders brought to the interior of the Congo many diseases previously not known there. The local people had no time to build up immunities, as they largely had to malaria, for instance. Both new illnesses and old ones spread rapidly because huge numbers of Congolese were now forced to travel long distances, as men conscripted to be long-haul porters or to work as steamboat crews. A large boat required from 20 to 60 woodcutters, or as soldiers impressed into the force publique. The most notorious killers were smallpox and sleeping sickness, although less dramatic lung and intestinal infections also took a high toll. Smallpox had been endemic in parts of coastal Africa for centuries, but the great population movements of the imperial age spread the illness throughout the interior, leaving village after village full of dead bodies. Akuba King, the successor to the one who had welcomed William Shepherd to the kingdom, died from the disease. Smallpox inspired a particular terror. The Africans called it the sickness from above, or the sickness of heaven, because the terrifying disease seemed to come from no familiar source. One traveller to the Congo came on a deserted town where a 15-foot boa constrictor was dining on smallpox victims' flesh, and on another where the vultures were so gorged that they were too heavy to fly. Sleeping sickness also spread lethally up the rivers. 500,000 Congolese were estimated to have died of it in 1901 alone. The disease is caused by a parasite first spread by the bite of the pink-striped tsetse fly, about the size of a horsefly, with a distinctive high-pitched buzz. Once contracted by humans, sleeping sickness becomes highly contagious. It can cause fever, swelling of the lymph glands, a strange craving for meat, and a sensitivity to cold. At last comes the immense lethargy that gives the illness its name. Faced with undeniable evidence of massive population loss, Leopold's apologists, then and now, blame sleeping sickness. And it is true that sleeping sickness and the other diseases would doubtless have taken many lives, even if the Congo had come into the 20th century under a regime other than Leopold's. But the story is more complicated, for disease rarely acts by itself alone. Epidemics almost always take a drastically higher and more rapid toll among the malnourished and the traumatized. The Nazis and Soviets needed no poison gas or firing squads to finish off many of those who died in their camps. Today, thanks in part to our century of famines and barbed wire, epidemiologists understand all too well the exact mechanisms by which this happens. Even in the Congo, one did not have to be a physician to see that those who were dying of disease were not dying of disease alone. Charles Grébin de Saint-Germain, a magistrate at Stanley Falls, wrote in 1905, "Disease powerfully ravages an exhausted population, and it's to this cause, in my opinion, that we must attribute the unceasing growth of sleeping sickness in this region. Along